This podcast delves into the dark, the depraved, and all things to keep you up at night. Listener discretion is advised. Now, sit back, pull the covers over your head, and allow yourself to be taken on a journey through the abyss.
Hey there, pod people. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Through the Abyss podcast. I'm your co-host, Mandy.
And I'm your co-host, Ben. And today we will be looking at Albert Fish because Mandy has determined herself to make me look at the most fucked up case in the history of cases that I've ever looked at, other than possibly like a Dahmer, because this is some fucked up shit. This might be worse than Dahmer. Thanks a lot, Mandy.
Hey, I'm here for you, brother. Yeah, but to that, on a serious note, this is a pretty heinous episode. It involves children, it involves murder, cannibalism, and a lot of other very depraved acts. So if you're sensitive to things like that, as much as I would love you to listen, well, you can listen to most of it, but when we get towards the end, I'm going to be playing a clip of what he did to one little boy, and then I'm also going to be reading the letter he sent to one of his victims' families. So just keep that in mind, and let's go ahead and get on with it. So as Ben said, we are talking about Albert Fish. He was born Hamilton Howard Fish, May 19th, 1870, in Washington, D.C. Now, he has a long family history of mental illness. Like, his uncle had mania, and I don't know specifically, like, what type. It didn't specify. His brother was sent to a state mental institution. I can't talk this morning. His sister was diagnosed with some kind of mental affliction. His mother supposedly had visual hallucinations. And there were three other relatives that were diagnosed with mental illnesses. Now, again, I can't get into specifics because I couldn't find anything specifically on them.
Yeah, and you won't, because in the 1800s, right, the DSM-5 was not where we have it today, where right. Everything's been classified, and you know, things like when they're talking about his sister diagnosed with mental affliction would not be a diagnosis anymore. That's just back in the day when they were like, we don't know what's wrong with you, but you're effed up.
Well, that, and she may not even had a mental illness, to be honest, because I mean, she just could have been moody or something. And
Definitely diagnoses that have been put in over the years too that have later been removed because they're not legit, and things that have been put in that might not necessarily need to have been, etc. I can name some, but I don't want to go into detail on that kind of stuff. That'd start a heated debate.
Yeah, well, you're gonna have to go into detail some pretty nasty stuff here in just a couple minutes, so yes. I'll save you that for the time being. Now, his father was 43 years older than his mother,
and I was trying to do the math on that, by the way. Like, sorry, not to cut you off right there, but just doing the math on that, I'm like, what age appropriateness? That's not even how you would speak in English. But what age does she have to be for that to be appropriate? And the only thing I can determine is she actually has to be 43 for that to be. No, because then he'd be 86. There's no way. I can't work out the math on this 43 year age gap.
I don't know how old his mom was, but I know he was 75, I think, when he died.
Then he must have found her hella young.
Well, I mean, there wasn't any kind of like legal age back then, you know. I mean, well, hell, even in the 40s, I guess, something like that. I'm horrible with math too, but my grandma got married when she was 14. So
But how old was her husband?
21.
Exactly. Like, I mean, that's not necessarily appropriate, but for him to be 43 years older than her, he's like in like great grandpa territory. He's like up there.
Celine Dion's husband was like, I think, 30 years older than she was. But I don't know.
Yeah.
Things were different back then. We'll just
Give the benefit of the doubt that maybe she was 20 when they got together. She was probably younger. He was 63 with a 20-year-old. That's like some Hugh Hefner crazy stuff. And by the way, for everyone thinks that was all like happy smiles and stuff, there are new articles out about some of the younger women that were with Hugh Hefner that said it was basically like rape. And they were young enough that I would say that like they were pushed into things, and not such a great scenario.
Yeah, I don't idolize old Hef at all. He Yeah, no.
He was a disturbing individual too. He just got away with it because society embraced it.
Oh yeah. All well, men especially. No offense to your gender there, Benny Boy.
I mean, fair.
But yeah, you know, there was quite an age gap. But now his dad died in 1875 and his mom wasn't able to care for him, so he got sent to St. Joseph's Orphanage in DC. Now, back then, if you weren't able to, you know, care for your kids, you could put them in an orphanage and just be done with it. And that's how a lot of kids were raised, unfortunately. And this particular orphanage, well, it wasn't great. I mean, there's a quote in here that from Albert that says, "I was there till I was nearly nine, and that's where I got started wrong. We were unmercifully whipped. I saw boys doing things they should not have done." And that's like a mild statement to some of the things I read that went on in this place.
Wait, okay, I just want to ask this. You said some things you read about what went on in the place. Was it all from him, though, or is this pretty much notoriously from different sources a messed up place? I mean, I believe, given the way he ended up, that it probably was. But he also could have been like severely mentally ill to the point where could make up things too. So are there other sources saying this place?
Stuff's coming from him, but I don't think he was making it up, just because when he was five, when he went in. So okay. Typically a five-year-old is not going to turn painful beatings into sexual pleasure.
Right.
And that's what he did.
Eventually. Other than in the movies, usually you're steered pretty correctly by the time not necessarily steered correctly, but not a lot has gone wrong by the time you're five, as far as your own actions.
Right. And from everything that I've found on him up until he was five, until he went to the orphanage, I mean, he had a normal, you know, other than daddy being really, really old, a normal childhood, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing bad, nothing, no beatings like that. But the orphanage is where I think he got
transformed. And I said, like I said, with the way he turns out and the way this case all goes, it's like, it's 100% probably likely that 99.9% likely that this place was a horrible place. It's mm-hmm. just that, like, also you have to kind of look at the other side of the coin and say, with the way this human being is, you got to also consider the source a little bit, right?
Like, he's absolutely. But I mean, excuse me, the confessions and everything that he gave, and I mean, there were forensics, well, quote unquote forensics, to back up the things he says. I don't think he lied about things. I think he actually enjoyed telling
all the truth.
Yeah.
Nothing but, you know,
I think he liked that shock value to it.
Well, I think for sure. I mean, you alluded to or said that we're going to get to that letter later, and we will, and I won't give any details of it whatsoever, but that letter's horrifically graphic, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like I'm writing this not only because it's what happened, but mm-hmm. because I want you to know what happened, because I want you to be extremely bothered by what happened. You know what I mean? It's a messed up letter.
It's crazy. And that'll be the last thing we discuss on this episode. We'll leave on a bang. But back to the orphanage, this kind of goes to, well, he said that there were regular beatings, you know, physical and sexual abuse, a lot of humiliation, a lot of torture, really sadistic acts of brutality. And as I said, there was something along the lines, something that triggered in his brain that pain became pleasure. And this is something that kind of played out throughout his lifetime. But my thing is it kind of, because everybody talks about nature versus nurture and all that other stuff, but this is like, to me, both, because you've got the mental illness very predominant in his family, and then you've got this horrible, horrible living condition that, you know, I think would break a lot of people. Not saying that everybody would turn into Albert Fish, because obviously that doesn't happen, but I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, yeah, I think that the things that he's saying that occurred would definitely hurt anybody. And then he does have an extreme amount of biological predisposition to mental disorders. So yeah, I mean, I agree with you on that for sure. As far as like the specific ways that it occurred in him, I'm thinking that that's just like I kind of said before we started with you, it's just like he is just a perfect ticking time bomb on this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't think you could make this compilation of events with any other human being at any other, you know what I mean? Like it's
a perfect
story. It had to be the right person at the right time in the right place with the right abuse.
Yeah.
And that's how you get an Albert Fish.
I agree with that. Cause I mean, you put people in this situation, and I mean, some of them come out, obviously they have PTSD, but mm-hmm. can, you know, live a normal life. Others, yeah. I'm sure, have to be highly medicated, while others, you know, revert into dissociative identity disorder to cope with things.
Yeah.
Or you can go Albert Fish's way.
Yeah. My imagination on it would be, or my inkling on it would be, that most human beings, if you were doing like a percentage overall, would be like the beaten cat. They would just stay away from other people for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think. Yeah. For those who, yeah, I don't know. It's just so odd. Just, you know, the way personalities form, and it's just very crazy. Especially, I mean, he went way left.
He did. And some people are actually just very much more sensitive than other human beings. And if you're sensitive, I'm not saying that, like I said, anyone would have been definitely affected by this situation. These are horrible things. Being beaten, sexual abuse, humiliation, torture. Those are things that would affect anyone. But the reason why I say I feel like he has like a hypersensitivity is because of this one line you have here, where he changed his name to Albert because kids called him Ham and Eggs, because his first name was actually, what, Hamilton, right?
Right.
Right. So changing your name to Albert because kids call you Ham and Eggs, to me, is you are, and he might not have started that way. It might have been from the abuse and the humiliations, etc. He's gotten to the point of this hypersensitivity, because you can call me Ham and Eggs all you want. I don't care. Like, not even a factor, not a thing, doesn't bother me, all good, right? But this person has been beaten mentally to the point of sensitivity where, like, something that small, he's going to change his whole identity, which is a little bit drastic.
But you're not classifying this as DID, though. I mean, this is him just changing himself, you know, one mindset, not split off into...
No, yeah, I'm not saying that he's got a second personality occurring at all. No, not at all. No, I'm saying what you said, which is he just is so much trying to not be hurt that even something so small as calling him a name, which really isn't that bad. I've been called way worse in my life. It affected me, not to that level, right? You know, I still use my own name, right? Not that anyone made fun of Benjamin, but, well, okay, well, my initials are BJ.
Yes.
You don't think, yeah, I hear that shit? Come on. It's worse than calling someone Ham and Eggs, but I'm not going to change my name. I'm just saying that, like, he was so sensitive to being called that he had to pick a whole new name, right?
Right.
So that they couldn't use that anymore. And then if they found some reason to make fun of Albert, he would have changed it again. So I'm not saying he changed his identity, like his actual interior self, but I'm saying, if you think about it drastically, your name is connected to your identity. He had to change who he was to get rid of this stupid nickname.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's probably part of the transformation too. You know, Hamilton died, the little innocent Hamilton, he was gone.
Yeah.
And enter the monster of Albert Fish.
Yeah.
It's a sad thing. His mom actually did get back on her feet. She got some kind of government job and took him out of the orphanage. But once he was at home, and again, he's like 9-10 years old at this time, he began a relationship with another boy. I don't have any information on this other kid. I don't know if they were like same age, or, you know, if the other boy was older, but this kid introduced him to coprophilia and urophilia. And I'm going to let you discuss this, because
that's what you're studying.
It's gross.
DSM, like say, it likes to break down things specifically. Coprophilia being feces, urophilia being urine. Why those wouldn't just be the same
and category? By that, it's ingesting feces and urine. Yeah.
So ingesting, why those wouldn't be the same, I don't know. And how did it say that this boy introduced this to him, or wow, it's very, like I said, everything's like a ticking time bomb to me. It's like perfect person, perfect place, perfect situation, because you look at Fish's life coming from that orphanage where he's been introduced to all levels of humiliation and abuse. And then when he gets out, he meets this boy that he has a relationship with that looks like he might actually be more fucked up than Fish, right? Like, this
guy... Like attracts like.
Right? This guy's... that's true, right? Because you figure when Fish came out, he probably wasn't the most socially normal person. He had gone through so much. So he probably couldn't have gotten, like, all the kids in the neighborhood to be his buddies. This is, like, the one kid he connects to. And this kid eats poop and drinks urine and...
What like psychological disorders would that fall under? I mean, I'm sure there's more than one.
You know what? I have no idea.
Because with him, I would think it would gravitated more towards the sexual, because a lot of the things that he did was, I mean, he was a sexual.
Yeah. Sadist. And I assume when they say that he had a relationship with this boy, it was a sexual relationship, or they would have just said that they were friends. Right. So the eating and drinking of poop, they're eating and drinking each other's in a sexual way. So yeah, it would probably fall into some sort of sexual disorder, and coprophilia and urophilia to me would be things that would be strongly comorbid with other disorders. I don't think they would ever exist by themselves is what I'm saying. You wouldn't just like to drink pee. Then the rest of my life is normal, right? Like it's gotta be comorbid with something, which like you said, in this case is probably a sexual disorder, which would be, I would say, actually 100%, whichever one's at the time eating or drinking, it would be sexual masochism, right? They're taking, it's a humiliation.
Well, that, and I think it might also possibly be a precursor to the cannibalism, you know, because you're still consuming
part of a human. Right. I mean, it actually would be the sexual sadism and masochism, right? Depending on if you're the giver or the taker.
Right. Which I'd say he was probably both. Because he liked to dole it out, but he also liked to take it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would, not to go too far in advance, but we're going to talk about like the nail paddle. He liked to be paddled with nails.
Oh, and God, yeah.
Like he likes to be abused, yes. And like you said, from the orphanage, you know, he had a certain point where for some reason being abused and being in pain switched from pain to pleasure, right? So
yeah,
it's all kind of... Somehow his pleasure sensories have been distorted, and it's not something that's ever going back in this guy's life. I don't think at that point there was a level of mental health care that could have helped this person.
No, I mean, that would be like saying, you know, you can repress BTK's sexual fantasies. I don't think it's possible. You know, chemical castration, of course, one way to stop it, but you know, the fantasies, you can't, unless you're drugging these people up on like mad doses of lithium so they're basically just zombies. I mean, you can't repress somebody's mental state. I just don't think it can be done.
Well, and first you have to know about it. Unfortunately, I was thinking about this when I was looking through this, and I don't mean to say that everyone's got these horrifically dark, horrible things, but we definitely live in a culture and society where everything sexual is so repressed, at least in America, right? So repressed.
It really is.
That people have these secret lives. I mean, even a normal sex life is a secret life. Your most normal sexual coupled friends aren't going to just sit there and tell you about their sex life. It's a secret life. So for these things to be happening for these people who are disturbed and have major issues going on, it's like no one will ever know, because it would have been a secret life regardless of whether it was normal or not. So
yeah,
part of the issue is, I mean, I'm not saying it Fish's issue is society, but part of the issue is that society is so repressed that we don't talk about what's normal sexually.
And that's true, because I mean, when we had Christina Cleave on, you know, and I asked her about the sex scenes and, you know, having to be naked in front of crews and, you know, having people see that, and I mean, she even said that it's a very American concept, because she said, what did she say, that she was more not disturbed, but more aware of her nakedness than it bothered her more than it bothered her parents, who are German, you know. Yeah. So you take Europe and it's just like, Well, I mean, European commercials too, you know, there's, you know, you have naked people on orange juice commercials in Europe. But so, yeah, I think that's a very good thing, which is very odd. I don't understand why
it is. I mean, because, like, if we never talk about sexual scenarios, mm-hmm. how do we teach young people that when they start that part of their life, that it should be a loving, mutually respective, beautiful thing instead of something disturbing? Right? Like, you can't if you never talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think people are told, well, I mean, I don't know. I've never, like, my parents never had conversations that, you know, don't go out and rape anybody because that's bad. You know, I think people just automatically assume it's something that you wouldn't do on a normal basis.
Right. However, like, you would definitely tell your children, hey, don't take something from the store. That's not right. Hey, don't punch your friends. That's not right. Hey, share with the other kids, right? You would teach them every level of everything except anything sexual is taboo to speak about.
Which so, all of that is our learned responses. Right. So it should be the same with anything sexual too. But
absolutely.
I don't know. I mean, I don't have kids. I don't want kids.
Like I said, I'm not saying at all.
I might have a problem talking to them too, but I think it would be a good idea. But again, it's because I've got that American sexual repression thing.
We do. And it's a problem. Because, yeah. Like I said, I don't think speaking to Albert Fish about proper sexual situations would have stopped him from being Albert Fish. He's been through too much stuff.
Right.
All I'm saying in that regard is that as we come into, like, the power of, like, the Me Too movement and stuff, we can't have expected boys to have grown up with normal concepts of how they're supposed to treat women when it's never been taught to them.
Right.
You can't expect women to know how they're supposed to be properly treated at this point because it's never been taught to them, right? Because no one talks about it.
Well, I think women know when it's inappropriate and when guys shouldn't be doing stuff, and vice versa. I mean, women, you know, abuse men as well.
Right. But we're talking to the extreme degrees. I mean, people.
Yeah.
Know,
yeah.
Right. But I'm talking about even, like, in the small degrees that lead up to the extreme degrees, like an Albert Fish,
mm-hmm.
they're never addressed.
Yeah, that's true. You know, yeah, I don't know. But then, you know, on the other hand, it's like, we're so sexually repressed that when a guy's coming on to another girl, maybe, you know, being a little bit graphic, you know, that's his opinion. Why should we take it personally? You know, it's, you can really go both sides of that coin. If you're going to talk about sexual repression, it's just, I don't know. It's weird. And we're going to go off on a big tangent because I can talk about
this. Yeah. Before, and we don't need to go any further. It's all I was trying to say in regards to, like, someone like an Albert Fish is it's no one would ever know because you don't know about the sex life of, like, pretty much anybody, right?
Right.
We've all got, like, that one friend who says whatever the fuck they want, and we know. But other than that one friend.
I don't know that I do. My friends are pretty, you know, we don't discuss.
Straightforward?
We don't discuss stuff like that.
Yeah, me neither, really. But I know I've met people in my life who were willing to say whatever they
wanted. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have too. Yeah. Yeah. I do know a couple. Yeah, okay. So anyway,
they exist. And you know what, though, the sad thing is the world looks at those people like they're the crazy ones.
I know,
but they're the most open honest human beings.
No, they would be perfectly fine in Europe. It's America who looks at them like they're wrong.
Right.
Okay, so moving on. 1890, Albert's around 20 at this time. He moves to New York City and he worked as a prostitute, and this is when he started molesting boys on a regular basis. He basically would lure kids away from their homes. He would torture and then he would rape them. He did like using this paddle that he made that he pounded sharp nails into. So the nails would stick out on one side and he would beat them with this paddle. And as time progressed, the depravity of his acts did as well. They got worse. You know, the whole torture and rape turned into murder and cannibalism. Now, this is what I find funny. In 1898, he did marry and he fathered 6 kids. Now, from all accounts that I've gone over, the kids had a normal life. Like, he didn't sexually abuse them or anything like that. up until his mom left, or up until his wife left him for another guy. This was in 1917. But he still wasn't touching them. He was, however, asking his kids to beat him with that nail paddle. And he also, I don't know why, I guess it's that pain pleasure thing, but he would stick needles into his groin area, into his pelvis area. And they actually did an x-ray of this, and you could see, and there are pictures online, you can see the needles that are like lodged in his groin and his pelvis area. It's insane. Yeah, I know you could never do that because you don't do needles. So
there's also other reasons why I could never do that, but
well, you know, yeah, you're not totally insane. So but after his marriage was completely ended, he would place these personal ads in the newspaper seeking women to do these crazy, you know, graphic sexual acts on him. Now the papers never ran these ads because they were graphic apparently, but they were used as evidence against him in his trial, which,
yeah. And you know what, like, he had to have realized after like the first couple letters. He might have even realized before he sent a letter that they were never going to air or put these letters in the actual paper. But it's kind of what we were talking about with his letter to the victims later. And he's likes that shock value. He knows, yeah, someone at the newspaper is going to read this letter and be like, what the F? And that, right, was enough for him. That's the whole reason to write it, because he knows they're never going to be put in the paper.
Yeah, he is something else. So yeah, he was definitely a paper guy. So 1928, this 18-year-old kid named Edward Budd put an ad in the newspaper seeking work. And unfortunately, Albert happened to see this. So he called upon the Buds. He went and visited them, and he used the name Frank Howard. When he met with them, he told them that he was a farmer on Long Island and he was looking for strong help, you know, to help him around his farm. He was, of course, like every serial killer is, very polite and very gentle, and really got the Budd family to trust him, which was such a huge mistake. He was supposed to come back a week later to get Edward, but something came up and he couldn't make it. So he sent them a telegram telling him that he would be back on June 4th to get Edward and one of his friends to take him back to his farm. So he actually did come back on June 4th. He came bearing gifts for all the kids, and he visited with the family over lunch, and the Budd family considered him to be this loving grandfather type. And if you see a picture of him, if you didn't know the things that he's done prior to looking at his picture, you would think, okay, well, this guy, there's no way in hell this guy could hurt a fly, let alone cannibalize a bunch of kids. But yeah, so I mean, he just had that trustworthy look like most of them do. Now, once he was there, he fell in love. Like, his original thing was to take Edward and do whatever the hell he wanted to do with Edward. But once he saw Grace, she apparently came and sat down on his lap while they were eating lunch and gave him a kiss on the cheek. And he was like, okay, I'm going to eat this kid. That's what he decided. So he came up with this ruse that he was going to his sister's house for some child's birthday party, and said, you know, asked if Grace could go because she would have a lot of fun playing with other kids and being around other people and all that other stuff. So her parents agreed. They dressed her up, sent her on her way, and she was never seen again. That's,
I mean, it's easy for me to judge this situation because we live in today's age. No one in their fucking right mind would let some random dude they just met take their young child.
Well,
but back then, probably.
Well, yeah, because I mean, hell, when I was young, we left our damn doors unlocked. Like, nobody locked their doors. Yeah,
same.
You know, everybody, you had to have a reason to be distrustful of somebody. And he was so good at, you know, he was very charming and was just very good at getting people to trust him. So he really had that working for him. Now, yeah, this investigation lasted 6 years. Until they actually got a break. Now, November 11th, this is where it gets kind of bad. November 11th, 1934, Mrs. Budd received an anonymous letter, and it described in detail the murder and cannibalism of her daughter, Grace, who Grace at that time was 10. Now, the police, I don't know how they did this, because it was 1930s, but they supposedly traced the paper that the letter was written on to some flop house where Fish was living. Now, they arrested him, and he immediately confessed to killing Grace and the other kids. And the cop said when he was giving his testimony and talking about, like, the details of what he had done to all these kids, like, he was smiling. So, again, you're going back to that. He's totally enjoying the shock value of it.
Yep.
I mean, it's and I'm going to play something because I honestly didn't want to read this one here in just a couple minutes that talks about, you know, what he did. And this guy, I mean, he was just totally matter of fact about the things that he did. And it's, I don't know. It's just insane to me. March 11th, 1935 is when his trial began. He pleaded innocent by reason of insanity. He said that voices told him to kill kids and commit horrible crimes. That, I think, was a lie. I don't think he had voices in his head.
Yeah, I think that's too convenient. He had never spoken of that prior. It's a real good defense.
Well, yeah, that's all it was. It was just a made-up defense because, I mean, his letters and his confessions,
I do want to put out there, I mean, from talking to Martina and also other things I've read, as far as the insanity plea goes, right? Because we've talked about it before as well, where it's like, is this guy insane? 100%. But insanity plea for a criminal case isn't about whether or not you have a mental disorder. It's about whether or not you actually understand that you committed the crime and that it was wrong.
At the time of the crime.
If you cannot, at the time of the crime, yes. And if you understand that the crime is wrong and you understand that you did it, then you are criminal. I mean, then you are.
What is it? Non mentis compass or something like that? The legal term? Something like that, yeah. So, but again, this is in the 30s, so I doubt very seriously they had those kind of regulations.
Any criteria for that, back then, that you probably, it would have taken like the grace of God to get you a criminal actually insanity out of something. Like, you could literally have voices coming from the sky and they'd be like, no, you're fine.
Well, I think the gravity of the acts that he did, even if he was insane, because I mean, he had numerous psychiatrists testify to his insanity, like the different diagnoses that they came up with at his trial. And his trial lasted,
and they probably did back then, and they probably did back then, and they probably believed it. But I think now that Albert Fish still would have been deemed able to stand trial.
Now definitely. I think he would, especially the way he presented his confessions. Absolutely. So 10-day trial, the jury found him sane and guilty, despite what the psychiatrist and everything pointed to. He was sentenced to death by electric chair. And back then, they weren't sitting on death row for 20 years. So January 16th, 1936, he was electrocuted at Sing Sing Prison. And now this is just rumor, and nothing has ever been brought out to say it's true, but it's rumored that he said this was the ultimate sexual thrill, which, given his history, sounds like something he would say.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if he said that at some point pain turned into pleasure for him, what more pleasure could there be than dying in an electric chair, which can't be pleasant?
Oh, I can't imagine it being pleasant. No. I think it took, they said, 3 minutes for him to die in the chair.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why everyone's switching to lethal injection. The electric chair is notoriously brutal.
I would rather be shot by firing squad. Just me personally. So he was convicted of, Grace and everything, but there's a timeline of his known murders, and then there's also some other suspected murders. Now, July 15th, 1924, Francis X. McDonald, who was 8 years old, he was sexually assaulted, strangled, and they found him hanging from a tree. Now, February 11th, 1927, little Billy Gaffney, he was 4 years old. I'm actually going to play you the YouTube clip of Albert's actual confession of what he did to Billy. And this is where I'm going to warn you that it gets extremely graphic. So if you can't handle this, this is when I would silence it.
I brought him to Riker Avenue Dumps. There is a house that stands alone, not far from when I took him. I took the boy there, stripped him naked and tied his hands and feet and gagged him with a piece of dirty rag I picked up. out of the dump. Then I bend his clothes, threw his shoes in the dump. Then I walked back and took the trolley to 59th Street at 2 a.m. and walked from there home. Next day, about 2 p.m., I took tools, a good heavy cat o' nine tails, homemade, short handle. Cut one of my belts in half, slit these halves in six stripes about 8 inches long. I whipped his bear behind till the blood ran from his legs. I cut off his ears, nose, slit his mouth from ear to ear, gouged out his eyes. He was dead then. I stuck the knife in his belly and held my mouth to the body and drank his blood. I picked up 4 old potato sacks and gathered a pile of stones. Then I cut him up. I had a grip with me. I put his nose, ears, and a few slices of his belly in the grip. Then I cut him through the middle of his body, just below the belly button. Then through his legs about 2 inches below his behind. I put this in my grip with a lot of paper. I cut off the head, feet, arms, hands, and the legs below the knee. This I put in sacks weighted with stones, tied the ends and threw them into the pools of slimy water you will see all along the road going to North Beach. He came home with my meat. I had the front of his body I liked best, his monkey and peewees, and a nice little fat behind to roast in the oven and eat. I made a stew out of his ears, nose, pieces of his face, and belly. I put onions, carrots, turnips, celery, salt, and pepper. It was good. Then I split his cheeks of his behind open, cut off his monkey and his peewees, and washed them first. I put strips of bacon on each cheek of his behind and put them in the oven. Then I pickled 4 onions, and when the meat had roasted about 1/4 hour, I poured about 1 pint of water over it for gravy and put the onions in. At frequent intervals, I bashed his behind with a wooden spoon, so the meat would be nice and juicy. In about 2 hours, it was nice and browned, cooked through. Never ate any roast turkey that tasted half as good as sweet fat little behind did. I ate every bit of the meat in about 4 days. His little monkey was as sweet as a nut, but his peewees I could not chew. Threw them in the toilet. This is an actual confession made by the serial killer Albert Hamilton Fish.
Good God.
If that doesn't make you want to become a vegetarian, I don't know what will. That is his actual confession. I mean, you could just... There's no remorse in this guy whatsoever at all. He was doing.
I mean, not to go back to sexual repression. I just want to go back to sexual repression for like a half second, though.
Okay.
This guy can do whatever to anybody.
Yeah.
And he says monkey and peewees, like, to the point where it's like, I'm trying to figure out which is which and what's happening, because he can't even just say penis and testicles.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
it was disturbing and graphic, but the guy talks like a 5-year-old. Like, if you were talking to a 5-year-old about body parts, it'd be like monkey and peewees.
Well, maybe he didn't know better.
Maybe he legitimately didn't know what they were called. Like a child. Still.
Yeah, I told you it was graphic. And
oh my God.
Yeah. Well, we still haven't gotten to the grace yet.
He said he cut the legs below the knees.
Yeah.
I wonder how.
Probably with a meat cleaver.
I mean, I guess I was thinking about the bone, but you can get between the. I don't know. I don't know how that works.
I think if you can disarticulate them, you can.
Yes. Yeah. He's separated.
I can't do it with bones.
It's all disturbing. Yes. It's all a mess. Hey.
Oh, the thought of bones just. Oh, it makes. It's like. Fingers on chalkboard to me. It gives me the willies. So that was poor little Billy Gaffney. And this kid was 4 years old. And what they didn't say was that he had gagged him and stripped him of his clothes. He left them there overnight. He was in that junkyard by himself overnight, alone, 4 years old. 4 years old. I can't even begin to imagine what that poor little kid went through. I don't want to imagine, because he was tortured completely. Now, Grace Budd, there was only three known murders. Grace Budd was a third, and that was June 4th, 1928. And again, she was 10. Now, other suspected murders, October 3rd, 1926, Emma Richardson, who was 5. 1927, Yetta Abramowitz, who was 12. May 2nd, 1931, Robin Jane Liu, who was 6. February 15th, 1932, Mary Ellen O'Connor, who was 16. And December 15th, 1932, Benjamin Collings, who was 17. These last two, I'm a little bit surprised. They seem like they would be a little bit too old for him. But because, I mean, typically pedophiles don't, they usually stick to around the same age, don't they? Usually.
You would think. And I think that's pretty much the norm. And I would also think that both Mary Ellen O'Connor and Benjamin Collins would have been old enough to fight back. So you're going for someone who usually doesn't probably get a whole lot of struggle because the kids are too young.
Yeah.
So now he's got kind of an ordeal, right? So, and he's a little bit older.
Yeah.
So I don't know why he would have made that change.
I don't know. Maybe they were, well, he,
unless he drugged them or something like that. I mean, obviously we don't know. These were suspected, so I don't know the details on them. But.
Well, he did like to go after Black kids and disabled kids because in his mind, the police didn't look for them as long, which is horrible to say, but I mean, that's why he did it. So, I mean,
especially the two older ones could have been disabled. It was probably 100% true in the 1800s, right? So
early 1900s.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's just the sad fact. So the two older ones could have been disabled in some way, making it easier for him to, true, you know, do what he needed to do. All right. So this is the Grace Budd letter. This is the letter that got Albert Fish caught and convicted and sentenced to death. And this is his 100% actual words. My dear Mrs. Budd, in 1894, a friend of mine shipped as a deckhand on the steamer Tacoma, Captain John Davis. They sailed from San Francisco to Hong Kong, China. On arriving there, he and two others went ashore and got drunk. When they returned, the boat was gone. At that time, there was a famine in China. Meat of any kind was from $1 to $3 a pound. So great was the suffering among the very poor that all children under 12 were sold to the butchers to be cut up and sold for food in order to keep others from starving. A boy or girl under 14 was not safe in the street. You could go in any shop and ask for a steak, chops, or stew meat. Part of the naked body of a boy or girl would be brought out and just what you wanted cut from it. A boy or girl's behind, which is the sweetest part of the body and sold as veal cutlet, brought the highest price. John stayed there so long he acquired a taste for human flesh. On his return to New York, he stole two boys, 1 7, 1 11, took them to his home, stripped them naked, tied them in a closet, then burned everything they had on. Several times a day and night, he spanked them, tortured them to make their meat good and tender. First, he killed the 11-year-old boy because he had the fattest ass and, of course, the most meat on it. Every part of his body was cooked and eaten except head, bones, and guts. He was roasted in the oven, all of his ass, boiled, broiled, fried, stewed. The little boy was next, went the same way. At that time, I was living at 409 East 100th Street, rear, right side. He told me so often how good human flesh was, I made up my mind to taste it. On Sunday, June the 3rd, 1928, I called on you at 406 West 15th Street, brought you pot cheese and strawberries. We had lunch. Grace sat in my lap and kissed me. I made up my mind to eat her. On the pretense of taking her to a party, you said yes, she could go. I took her to an empty house in Westchester I had already picked out. When we got there, I told her to remain outside. She picked wildflowers. I went upstairs and stripped all my clothes off. I knew if I did not, I would get her blood on them. When all was ready, I went to the window and called her. Then I hid in the closet until she was in the room. When she saw me all naked, she began to cry and tried to run down the stairs. I grabbed her and she said she would tell her mama. First, I stripped her naked, how she did kick, bite, and scratch. I choked her to death, then cut her in small pieces so I could take my meat to my rooms, cook, and eat it. How sweet and tender her little ass was, roasted in the oven. It took me 9 days to eat her entire body. I did not fuck her, though. I could have, had I wished. She died a virgin. he didn't actually sign this letter, but I can't, as a parent, even begin to comprehend how I would take this letter if somebody had written it to me.
It's absolutely, like, it's like re-victimization, right?
It's extreme shock. I mean, that's, I think if there was anything human left in Albert, that it was gone by the time he wrote this letter. Because it's just.
Yeah, and I feel at this point he wanted to get caught. And the reason I say that is I know they said they traced him to the letter because of the flop house he was in, but he also says an exact time and location of where he lived, which would be something that they could determine.
Maybe if he gave his real name.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, back then you didn't really have IDs and stuff like that. But yeah, I see what you're saying.
But see, yeah, they could figure out what human beings lived if it was the right name. Yeah.
So it's a path. Yeah. Now, this has been 6 years after Grace had been missing. I think, given the gravity of this letter, I think I would have wished to remain ignorant as to what happened to her at that point. Yeah. I don't know if I could, you know, that would be something that would be in my head every single minute of every single day, of knowing how my kid, how her last, you know, hours were. I don't know that I would, that's something I would have really wanted to know.
No, it's not. And Fish wasn't doing it for her benefit. I said, this is just a re-victimization. He's trying to just get more pleasure out of this because, number one, if you're going to send this entire letter in its entirety, you would send it to the police, and then the police would break down the information she needed, which is, we figured out, or we've got this letter and we're trying to figure out who wrote it, but your daughter is gone, right? Like, if you send this letter in its entirety directly to the person's parent, all you're trying to do is shock them and cause them more pain and horror. Or else it would just say, I'm sorry I killed your daughter, right? You know what I mean? Like, it wouldn't have been this. This was a bragging.
Yeah. I mean, because there was a small part of me that kind of thought, well, maybe he doesn't understand that this is something that's so awful, normal people would not want to hear about this. Because to him, this is completely normal. You know, and I don't know. I mean, I think ultimately,
it's, I mean, like, I guess that's a possibility. Because he does throw in the last line, which is that she died a virgin. I didn't have sex with her.
Right.
But the only reason I can think that you would put that is he's trying to give her some sort of peace of mind. But it's like, you just said the most horrific shit. Like, that line doesn't even matter.
Yeah. 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 I don't know. This is, I think of everything that we've covered so far, this is probably the most gruesome and just in your face. And honestly, I think if it didn't involve kids, it wouldn't be as bad, but kids are just that natural trigger, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to see anybody get cannibalized and beaten or anything, but especially not a kid.
Yeah, this has all the aspects of worst case scenario of every possible realm of, I mean, to me, it's like, it's almost like the DSM-5 needs a new class of, or a new category, which is fucked up beyond recognition, right? The FUBU.
FUBAR.
Because this is like such an extreme compilation of mental disorders and circumstantial, like, atmospheric issues. And like, this is not like, you can't just say he had this. This is all normal for that diagnosis. No. Like, well, no diagnosis does this all fall under.
What I'm curious to know is that if he had never gone to that orphanage, how he would have actually turned out.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think he would have actually been a lot better off. I don't think he would have been necessarily the most normal person in the world, but we might not even know his name, meaning he might not have committed like heinous crimes. And the reason I say that is because the fact that his mother went back to get him, to me, says he actually had a loving parent, a caring.
Oh yeah. His parent. Mom cared for him. Yeah.
Yeah, so he would have had like a very different upbringing had that orphanage not been involved.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he would have done all the things that he did, but there's still got to be, there has to be that predisposition to that kind of violence. I don't think it just, and I mean, I don't know, because obviously you don't know people's makeup and everything, but for me, it just seems like, yes, that was a horrible thing, and yes, it probably triggered some crazy shit in you and all this other stuff, but I mean, I know people who have been severely abused who don't turn out to murder other people, you know, or abuse other people or things like that. It's just, I think there had to be some predisposition
of that and type of biological predisposition from it. Like, obviously, like, at
like
least
the pedophilia,
his immediate family.
I think he would have been a pedophile without doubt. I mean, that may have been the extent of it, but
it's possible, but it is also possible that he's introduced to, like, I don't know what the humiliation he's talking about in the orphanage is, but I mean, maybe people were making the kids touch each other and things like that in the orphanage. There are, I mean, I'm saying, like, 100% I'm with you on the, he's got predisposition for all kinds of mental issues, but I don't think he would have been introduced to the violence and to the naked children and if he had not gone to that orphanage. I think that
what
that
about the
a
little boy
role.
He met?
The little boy he met, I actually thought about that before you asked me the question, so I'm glad you asked me the question, because I feel like there's a possibility, had he not been at orphanage and he had met that little boy, he would have said, "Hey, mom, this kid's really messed up. I need to not be near him." Right? Like, it might have been a different scenario. Or it might have worked out the same. You really can't tell until it happens. But I, like I said, I think it's just this guy had nature and nurture both colliding in this horrible, colossal accident that made him.
I wonder if his mom knew about the shit that he was doing before she died.
My guess
is you don't
see she knew some. Parents are unconditional. They love their kids. She had to have known he wasn't a normal child. And by that time, a normal adult.
Well, given everything he went through, he would have had to have been showing major signs of some type of PTSD.
Yeah.
If you don't come
we know
away
they didn't
that,
have
I'm
a ton
saying.
Of money, right? So it is also possible, had she gotten him out of the orphanage and realized some things had gone on, she might have actually taken him for treatment and stuff. It was like he had, like, his circumstantial background is almost as bad as his biological issues, because it's like they don't even have the money to try to combat what occurred to him in the orphanage, right? They can't put him in an outpatient care type of situation.
Right. What a crazy world we live in.
Yes.
Fascinating story, psychologically, and very, very disturbing all at the same time.
Yeah, I think you were saying earlier that experts have given him actually, like, what, 15 diagnoses? He's got much comorbidity. Comorbidity meaning that multiple diagnoses happening at the same time. He's got like 15 possibilities.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's a train.
But this was like back in the early 1900s. So I can't even imagine what people would say about him today.
Yeah.
These are like the psychiatrists who, you know, was testifying at his trial and things like that's what they gave him.
So I mean
he probably wouldn't have as many, because I'd say probably some of them are grouped together now, but
I mean, we definitely see sexual sadism, sexual masochism, right? The
pedophilia,
there's a lot going on. This case has a lot of
psychologically it's a fascinating storm. Case
It's a very fascinating case. It's just also, man, it's a damper. It'll put a damper on the day.
And yet, this is what we enjoy doing, folks.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah, I need to go, like, watch a Disney movie now, I think.
Yeah, I think something to cure the mind. I might need to go for a walk.
Go for
Hopefully
a walk.
The sun's out.
I need some chocolate. Well, thanks again for listening to this very, very crazy episode about Albert Fish today on Through the Abyss podcast. As always, you can get in touch with us through email at throughtheabysspodcast@gmail.com. We are also on Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat at Abyss Podcast 1.
Toodaloo. And thank you.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Well, Ben, we got another episode under our belts. Thanks so much for tuning in to Through the Abyss podcast. And until next time, keep it weird.
Spooky stuff!